Hey, Fresh Capital listeners. In this episode, we're continuing our deep dive into major investment trends by looking at mobility. Venture capital firms from around the world are pouring billions of dollars into travel and mobility tech startups, amounting to almost 10% of total VC funding across all industries. In this episode, we cover everything from rideshares to e-scooters to smart cities. Keep listening and enjoy. Welcome to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn about companies and investing. My name is Dan. Joining me, Albert. How are you?
Dan, I'm going good. How are you going?
I'm good. In Canberra again. As you're just saying, I've been Canberra, Brisbane, Canberra for the last couple of weekends. And apologies to listeners for the audio last week. I thought my sort of work microphone would be sufficient, but the quality didn't turn out as well as I thought it would.
Yeah, I mean, no one gets to see video on these, although we should start now that Spotify is doing video. But Dan looked like a little call center helper or like IT support.
Okay, I'm going to move swiftly on from that one, Albert, because I don't want to dive into it. Today, we're looking at mobility. Super interesting space. You know, I think this continues a last sort of episode theme of looking more at the sector as opposed to individual companies. And there's a lot in this space, you know, a lot of VC interest in mobility, a lot of money in mobility. So we're sort of going to break it down from the top to the bottom.
Yeah, and you know, Dan, I think you suggested today's episode. So, you know, was there kind of like a thesis or a thought behind it, or is there something kind of interesting you're looking
at? I remember early on in the Fresh Capital journey, when I was spearheading some of our social media sort of campaigns and materials, did a couple of dives into, you know, electric vehicles, mobility, and, you know, the thing just pops up that a lot of these startups, particularly the unicorns, the billion-dollar companies, they happen to be in Asia when it comes to mobility. So that sparked the obvious question of, is there something specific about Asia which makes mobility more of a pressing issue and therefore these companies more valuable? And if the answer is yes, or even if the answer is no, you know, what lessons are likely going to flow into more Western countries as well? So that was the sort of starting thesis, Albert.
Yeah, no, great, great call out. I think it's probably then worth probably spending a bit of time talking about whether there are those kind of underlying issues and problems that enable these mobility companies to thrive in Asia.
Yeah, so I mean, the obvious one, and this is sort of a similar point that we made on the last episode when it came to food tech, but there's just very, very densely populated areas in Asia. Funnily enough, two of the sort of big mega cities in Southeast Asia is Jakarta and Manila, so Indonesia and Philippines, which we both represent on the pod, Albert. But there's just like, you know, this huge opportunity where in these cities you have massive populations. And a good way, you know, what I found conceptually quite helpful to think of, well, what is mobility? It can mean so many things. It can mean Uber, it can mean some of the e-scooters, bikes, etc. Mobility is just the flip side to congestion. And I think that's a really clever way of looking at it, because all of these really densely populated cities, the problem they're trying to solve is congestion, traffic, and the solution is mobility in various forms.
Yeah, that's a really good call out, Dan. I love that definition. I think the other thing I'd throw in there, when you're talking about like really dense populations and cities like, you know, Jakarta and Manila, I think Asia also has, just by nature of its sheer size and its population, just the inverse of that as well, which is like highly spread out, highly fragmented, you know, not particularly dense, you know, cities, towns, villages, etc. If you think about like rural China, and you can really start to see the disparity in between, you know, regional Asia, which is, you know, things like Thailand, China, and how geographically spread the population is, and the mobility challenges associated with that versus like island nations, like the Philippines, like Indonesia, like Japan, who have highly dense cities and they've packed, you know, millions, if not tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people together, and they come with their own unique set of challenges. And then the other thing you then interlay is like, Asia has both. Asia has countries like China that has these highly fragmented populations who have mobility issues on one scale. And then they also have, you know, cities like Beijing, Shanghai, who also have the same challenges of like highly dense areas and the mobility issues associated with that.
So before we get a little bit deeper into mobility, I probably want to do our standard call out, which is to say, you know, not all Asian countries are the same. And a good way to highlight this is to talk about urban density. So as a sort of global average, 54% of countries' population reside in urban areas. So if you think of that as sort of the baseline, if you compare that to certain countries in Southeast Asia, you can start to see really interesting differences. Singapore, as an example, 100% of the population is in an urban area, which, you know, can then spark the thinking that's why Singapore has such a strong push towards being a smart city, because all of their population is in an urban area. So they're basically an outlier in terms of this whole conversation. You then go to countries like Malaysia and Brunei, 77% thereabouts in urban areas, ahead of the curve. But then the rest of Southeast Asia, Myanmar, Laos, Vietnam, even the Philippines, they're all sitting underneath that global average of 54% in urban areas, which just means that issues of mobility are going to become increasingly important to these countries, because you'd expect that their populations will continue to move into those urban areas, just as it's been the trend for the rest of the populations around the world in different countries.
For sure. And I think this also highlights probably another issue or challenge that creates these mobility problems, is that those urban areas came up relatively quickly. Like, a lot of people talk about how China developed over the past 40, 50 years. And you can really see how, you know, these mega cities, Manila, Jakarta, and then, you know, these other cities like Shanghai, Beijing, like, they just rose incredibly quickly. You compare that the timeline to like New York or London, where those cities slowly built on top of each other. You know, you've got this like rapid infrastructure development in these cities, which makes urban planning kind of difficult to do, and then city mobility difficult to plan on a long term. And then we're going to talk about it on the pod. When you start to layer all the new and different mobility issues and technologies that didn't exist 20, 30 years ago, like, it's almost impossible to proactively plan for what mobility looks like when you're just reacting so quickly.
100%. And, you know, some of those cities you mentioned, Jakarta, for instance, you know, it's sinking. They're literally building a new capital city in a different part of Indonesia because of that problem. So major issues. All right, Albert, we now know like the background, the context in which mobility is operating. So let's go a little bit deeper into mobility. What are some of the forms of mobility, the types of companies that have sort of really interested you as you've done your deep dive?
Yeah, so I mean, thinking about mobility in two kind of senses. The first is like macro mobility. And that's probably more what people traditionally think of mobility as, which is moving people, you know, items, cargo, shipment, et cetera, from either city to city or country to country. So if you think like, I want to go, you know, fly to Vietnam, the mobility channel, mode transportation would be a plane, potentially a ferry if I wanted to. But that is like on a large scale, moving across cities, continents, etc. And then there's kind of like macro mobility, which is where a lot of our discussion may end up, because that's where really the future of mobility is going, particularly around, you know, highly dense areas. But that's like kind of moving a person, cargo, shipment, equipment, etc., across a city or a town. So the way I was thinking about mobility, either on a macro scale and then a micro scale.
That's a nice way of putting it. And I think you're right that so much of the investment in mobility is in that micro scale, city sort of level. And that's because I think, you know, fundamentally, our country-to-country systems and infrastructure is quite good, is quite robust. And COVID has sort of highlighted the fact that everything was a very well-oiled machine until that disruption happened and the supply chains got a little bit mucked up. So then if we zoom in on the sort of micro level, Albert, I'm really interested to hear, like, if you had $10 and you got to put it on a type of mobility, whether that be like an Uber, a Grab, or whatever, and just focusing on the mobility part of their business, what's the one that you'd put that $10 in?
That's so funny that it's only $10. It's probably not going to make material impact. I'm gonna assume you meant $10 million.
Sure, Abbott.
And then I think just quickly, I mean, we're going to keep diving further and further into this, but you know, when we talk about micro mobility, that's obviously split into so many different verticals. Like, you know, we're talking about like Uber, Grab, which are things that consumers use. There's like elements of micro mobility that, you know, interplay with some of those technologies. And then there's things that we never see that underpin and enable that. So I'm not sure whether you're asking me whether I'm going to choose a particular subsection of micromobility and then how I allocate that 10 mil. But I guess for the purposes of this discussion, Dan, for your initial question, I probably wouldn't put it into a rideshare business. You know, I think we've talked in depth about I guess my dislike for rideshare businesses, because I think they're kind of commodity businesses. So if I had to choose where I put that 10 million, I'd probably put it in underlying infrastructure or middleware, but that's not that interesting of a conversation. So I'm just going to say I'm going to put it in Neuron Mobility.
Being the e-scooter company?
The e-scooter company that's come out of Singapore, Southeast Asia.
Okay, and tell me why, Albert.
So I think Neuron's doing some particularly interesting work around the e-scooter mobility space. They started in Southeast Asia. So they started from a point where they were working in like a highly dense area. And so based on that, they managed to get a country playbook up and running as to how to run, you know, how to run an efficient mobility business at scale in a country. And now they've replicated that across different Southeast Asian countries.
So like, and even Australia.
And even Australia. And so while I think that this is like a kind of a commodity, you see Beam, which is also another Southeast Asian company. You know, you see Lime, you see all these other, the city bikes, etc. Players moving into the space. You can just see them, but they're all different colors. I think the execution part, underpinned by the data that Neuron collect on their cities, positions them for success.
I agree. And I think it's a really interesting space to put $10 or $10 million out, because it's a very clear solution to a problem, which again is congestion or traffic. For people that live within, let's say, 5 kilometers of their workplace, you know, that being their daily commute, there is no reason why they need to hop in a car, no reason they need to hop on a bus or a train. They could bike, scooter, some other form of more nimble mobility transportation into work. And I think increasingly, you know, I when I was in Brisbane, I was scooting around on an e-scooter. There's that initial, the same as when I first started using Uber, that initial uncomfortability where I'm like, I don't know if I want to be doing this, blah, 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 blah. But then as soon as you do, and the ease of which you can sign up and start riding this thing within seconds, how low cost it is, you know, I was converted very, very quickly. And I'm probably one of those people that are later on the curve of early adopters. I'm like you, Albert. So I can really see e-scooters as like a fundamental part of cities in the future. And you can see that now. Like when you go to a city, they're a very like present part. They've got very flashy colors, purple or orange or green. And you can now start to see them throughout the cityscape.
Yeah, I want to quickly double click on your experience in Brisbane. Like, who did you use when it came to your scooter experience?
I used Neuron.
Okay, there you go. And how did you find the safety aspect of Neuron? Did you kind of look at, you know, their safety academy? Because that is a big part of their value proposition. Is safety.
Not at all. Not at all. I literally just thought, I need to get from A to B. I don't want to take an Uber. It's a bit far for that, or a bit short for that, rather. I had the choice between Beam or Neuron. Honestly, it was a coin flip. Like, and I think that's something we can talk about in a little bit, is the differentiating factor between these brands. Scan the QR code, downloaded the app, and I would have been using it within, you know, a minute, 2 minutes.
No, that's awesome. I think the other thing before we move on is like a lot of these companies and this, you know, you're asking me where I put my 10 million and I'm probably just going to keep talking about Neuron, but how that broadly interplays is that when you've got a lot of sporadic or different modes of transportation across cities, whether it's like e-scooters, bikes, you know, kick scooters, etc. You know, the real differentiating factor is the data that you can collect around who's using scooters, where they use scooters, where they go, and then what you do with that data. And what's really interesting is then feeding that data into councils, into urban planners, into infrastructure developers, so they can see, here's how people live in our city, and this is how people get around. This is therefore the evidence and the data required to build a city that's catered for micro mobility solutions. Like, I don't know about you, Dan, but walking around the city in the CBD is like nightmarish, because you've got people walking in every direction. You've got like delivery bikes, you've got people on scooters, you know, you've got the light rail. Like, the city in Sydney is not geared up for micro mobility solutions. And then if you layer on like Sydney times 10 for an Asian country, you're definitely not set up for what it takes to be like a highly dense urban area.
That's such a good point, because, you know, when you think about the development applications, local council applications that you need to even say get a bike path on a road, what you need there is evidence, is data, et cetera, to prove the usefulness of it. And an interesting sort of anecdote, I had a friend who was working for Lime. This would have been maybe 5 years ago when they were very, very new. And because, you know, as startups were, he was someone who picked up the bikes that were sort of left in odd locations, and sort of he would reclaim them, recharge the batteries. But because he was also sort of keen and had a good head on his shoulders, he was also helping with some of the strategy in terms of cutting up the data they got from their vehicles. And I remember him opening up the laptop one day and just sort of showing me the amount of data they pull and the way that they can cut it up and filter it by, you know, let's see all the people who only have 5 minute commutes, and then you can do it by a certain area, et cetera, et cetera. How many people use the app 3+ times a week? So all these different ways. And what was struck me actually was how, you know, this was 5 years ago, they were basically having the equivalent of like an intern crunching that data. I'm certain now that they've got, you know, much more robust people and teams working with that data to drive insights. I think it's a really fruitful area for them to obviously be gearing up the business in a much more professional and cohesive way.
Yeah, when you have a large data set that tells you how people move in your city, you know, that is an incredibly advanced insight into like consumer behavior. You know who doesn't have that technology and insight? Like government.
Yeah, great point.
And you can sell that, because that's a cornered resource, and a lot of mobility companies are trying, and you know, Uber always, people talk about their data play and how that, you know, works, but they've obviously got the same level of data at a global scale. And I think, you know, trying to harness that data is very difficult. You know, if you can't just have one intern crunching a spreadsheet when you have, you know, a global data set, you need machine learning, you need statisticians, you need mathematicians, etc. But that is really juicy data to sell to governments, urban planners, councils. And that's kind of the broader play for a lot of these mobility companies generally.
All right, Albert, where do you want to transition to now?
Look, we just talked about the consumer-facing part of micromobility. I think it's probably worth talking about what I've kind of deemed as like middleware and then back-end stuff. I know that's not as like sexy and glamorous, but these are like the underpinning technologies that support this.
So why don't you dive into that, Albert? Because we talked about it before recording, but I don't think you've defined it yet on the pod.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're very vague terms. So I think I've called in my research notes middleware mobility solutions as things that enable and speak to, you know, back-office solutions. And I'll talk to back-office solutions, but enable the use of e-scooters, rideshare, et cetera. So a really good example, I think, is like a navigation app. So as a consumer, yeah, the front-facing or the thing that solves the problem is the scooter. But what supports you in using the scooter effectively is like a navigation app or a parking app or a charging station or even payments. Like, these are things that help you get from A to B more efficiently, even though they don't directly help you get from A to B as a mobility solution. So that's what I think about middleware. And the classic ones, obviously, like Google Maps, because that is you know, like what the gold standard is for maps. But, you know, in Asia, you're starting to see that landscape change dramatically as you have, you know, more and more specific apps that people start to use. You know, you've got things like Wim, Moved, etc. And then you've got other things that help enable your infrastructure, things like charging stations for electronic bikes, payments platforms like Zepto. We've talked about a lot of payments previously on the app. So anything that's kind of enabling software that helps you get efficiently, helps you move efficiently, is what I've called middleware.
I really like that because this speaks to my experience again in Brisbane, Albert. Literally, I had my phone up and I was flipping between the Neuron app and then Google Maps to show me around. And that's just, that's a friction that I did not need in my life when if it could just be on one app. You could have the map within Neuron showing me the directions to the destination I want to go to. So I really like this idea of sort of enabling services, software, etc. So the other thing that to think about there is like a really interesting example out of Helsinki, which I know is in Asia, but there's actually a lot of innovations happening around the world for mobility. Their government's going towards a 2025 vision where essentially, you know, no one has to own a car in Helsinki. And one of the ways of help enabling that is to essentially have a seamless integration between, you know, your Google Maps or whatever. You know how you can choose the option where it shows you, you know, what public transport you can take? They have that service, but you can essentially find out what public service you want to take, pay for it, etc., get the ticket all in one transaction. And the interesting question for me then, Albert, is thinking about how ubiquitous Google Maps is as like an entry point to mobility in terms of finding out how to get from A to B, do you see then that stack actually coming together with them then integrating the mobility side of that equation?
No, for sure. And I think this is probably one of my like later points as we keep going, because the next thing is then back office. And then the next thing after that is like integrations and APIs. And so maybe if we talk about integrations and APIs, because we're now in this conversation, is like absolutely, like you just want to keep talking about your example, is you're on Neuron, you have to flick between Google Maps and Neuron Maps or whatever the Neuron app is that shows you where you're going. And so that is huge friction. And then you've got to, you know, potentially pay for it one particular way if it doesn't have payments integrated. But imagine if you're taking multiple forms of mobility. So now you have to switch between the two, right? If you're in Helsinki, maybe you're going from like a train to a scooter to for last mile, or maybe you're going from like rideshare to scooter, etc. And that's even more friction because you're now changing apps. And so something that would be super interesting is like integrating via API some of these apps into like Google Maps or vice versa.
And what I see happening there is because in some ways we think it's quite innovative having the tap and go, like, you know, the Opal card or whatever. And then the next innovation on that is you've got it on your phone, so you don't have to carry the card. You can just NFC tap your phone. But really, that's still kind of a step that's unnecessary. If I pull up Google Maps and it says, okay, Dan, to get to work, you have to take this light rail and then hop onto this ferry and then you're at your destination. Why can't I pay for those tickets then and there? And if on the train or if on the ferry a ticket person comes up to me, why can't I just sort of double click my phone and the payment proof is there as well? That way I'm not tapping on to each of these forms of transport. I'm simply walking on, walking off, and like in the background that payment's already occurred, that sort of thing. Like that's the future which should be happening in the next 10 years.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, we talked about payments very briefly, but you can even take it a step further, which is like GPS payments. Like as you're moving to location, you know, on a train, they charge you per like how far you go and things like that. So like if you take, you know, segment one or whatever, what do you call it, zone one, then that's like $4. If you go to zone two, that's $5. Zone three is $8 or whatever. But how they tap zones or how they check zones is like how you tap on and off. But what it is saying it's like you're in a particular location, you came from another location, which is mobility, and therefore to go from A to B costs you, you know, $8. So that you could do GPS-based payments and have no friction.
I'm really loving this conversation, Albert, but I'm conscious that I've taken you away a little bit from your middleware. Is there something in that middleware that you wanted to highlight particularly?
Not strongly, but the key one I want to call out is like root optimization. So I'm sure everyone's done this is listening to the pod. And now imagine trying to do this in another country that you're not familiar with, is that you open Google Maps. I'm just going to use a Sydney example. Open Google Maps. You want to go from where I live, which is like just on the outskirts of the city, to work, which is in Darlinghurst. There's like five ways I can go, right? There's like the bus, there's walking, there's DD, whatever. But if I choose to walk, now I've got like four options as to how it look like. Do I cut through the city? Do I cut through Central and go around? Do I go from Surry Hills to Darlinghurst? And the challenge here is that there's always like micro adjustments, right? As you walk, there's traffic lights that change. So in the moment, even though all three or four options might be like a 1 or 2 minutes difference, it's not going to be the same when I get to my destination. If I took one particular route, it might be 5 minutes faster or slower because of all the micro adjustments. And so a big thing is like over time that stacks up. 5 minutes every single day stacks up over a year, over 2 years, over 3 years as you commute. And that's true for anyone who's moving multiple things, so say like an Uber driver. So route optimization, especially for people who drive full time, whether it's deliveries, whether it's taxis, Uber drivers, is one of the most important parts of trying to get mobility right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think in this way, we have to sort of remove the consumer lens, which is very individual. Like as you say, Albert, it's 5 minutes for you. And I think the easier retort could be, you know, you're 5 minutes walking around outside, Albert, be present, enjoy the moment, relax. But on the much bigger scale, you know, when you look at some of the research reports into why mobility, you know, should be happening and should be geared up for, when you're talking about a mega city with 10 million plus people in it, 5 minutes each on their commute to work 5 days a week, etc., you're literally talking about like, I think the number was something like 21 billion hours saved, you know, in a year. And it's just like that really stacks up in terms of not at the micro level individually, but at the macro level when governments are talking about the productivity of their population, the well-being of the population, saving that time for them is, you know, when you think about hundreds of millions of dollars invested in toll roads and et cetera, usually that's only cutting maybe 15 minutes, 10 minutes off a commute. These incremental gains are really important for getting the most out of, you know, your GDP.
For sure. And I think even if you look on the business end, if you're Amazon or if you're Uber Eats or Grab, et cetera, and you're driving around every single day, if you can save 5 minutes per delivery, or even 2 minutes per delivery, you know, 2 minutes per passenger if you're doing rideshare, that over time aggregates as well because commuters only commute one way and back. So yeah. Really, the incremental savings is probably much smaller than someone who's doing this full time.
Oh, absolutely. I was reading Grab's financial reports and in their investor day sort of transcript, one of the main things they were talking about was an innovation to reduce wait times for their food delivery drivers at the sort of kiosk where they're picking up the food. And that translates to something like, you know, a 12 to 20% increase in that person's wage, because they're just being more productive in the amount of deliveries they can do per hour, which is a huge deal. I mean, if your boss came up to you and said, do you want a 12% pay increase? You know, you'd be on it for sure.
Absolutely. And I think as we're kind of on this thread, is that the last kind of piece of micro-mobility, so we've talked about consumer-facing, we've talked about middleware, we've talked about kind of APIs and integration. So there's probably two more, sorry. So I'm going to talk about back office. I know that's not particularly sexy as well. But again, Dan, you're on Neuron. You've taken the scooter. There's someone back at Neuron HQ who needs to know where every scooter is. Yep. You've taken it from A to B. They need to know exactly where every scooter is so they can track that movement because it's obviously their property. So they can do maintenance, because, you know, the scooters wear and tear. But the other thing is, like, they need to make sure that all those scooters are placed in the most optimum area of the city and not, you know, in some landfill somewhere thrown into the Brisbane River.
Yep. I'm really curious about this because I had a sneaky suspicion, because, you know, I've obviously been using these scooters in Brisbane, and, you know, after a couple of days, it's pretty clear if someone's looking at my habits, you know, and I don't think someone is. I think it's obviously digitized and there's some AI crunching these numbers. But obviously, I'm going back to the same hotel every time, and they're starting to pick up information about, oh, there's a user here who is likely in the morning going to be using this scooter. And what was interesting was, like, on one of my last days in Brisbane, I didn't scooter back to my location, so I didn't have my scooter there. But in the morning, there were two freshly charged scooters right outside my hotel, which, you know, could be a coincidence, could be other users or whatever. But it made me think whether that was responding to particular user behavior of there being like a rider in this area who's likely to use this form of transport.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, if there was multiple people in your hotel and who were potentially using it or using it over time, they could see that maybe at this hotel, there's a group of people who are going to the same place. And therefore, because they're going to the same place, they're probably the same party or whatever. Like, let's put scooters there available for them. They've already shown the appetite to use the product. They need to go around because they're staying in a hotel because they're not from this city. How do we keep nudging people who have the attributes we want to use our product?
I like that idea of nudging, Albert, because it sounds very benign as opposed to tracking my behavior and stalking me to my hotel, leaving a bike outside.
I mean, there's you could probably just go to LinkedIn and find like data analyst, neuron mobility, and send them a message and just be like, dude, I know what you're doing. Stop it.
Zooming out slightly from the e-scooter example, Albert, you know, in terms of other back office services, which I was picking up on and thought was particularly interesting, is just this idea of all the logistics and last mile delivery services. So this is around the movement of packages, less consumer facing, but obviously still incredibly important for how cities just sort of operate and run. Is there anything in that space that interested you, or do you want to sort of move into our closing section?
No, I think last mile is like really, really interesting. It's not something I'm hugely familiar with, but from organizing like who picks up last mile, who does delivery, like the amounts they can take, the optimization of that, like that's probably a conversation we could have another time.
Yep.
But it is worth calling out that that is obviously a huge challenge within this small vertical of mobility to solve.
So the last section I want to sort of move to, Albert, is just sort of looking at what does this mean then for industries, for businesses, etc. You know, where are the opportunities and where are the potential bear cases? And, you know, you'll see in my notes there's this neat little sort of almost heat map, which is done by McKinsey. And a side of the ecosystem I hadn't thought of, which they're really, I guess, skeptical about, is the traditional auto industry. Because essentially what they're saying is, what industry is most disrupted by mobility? It's traditional car dealers, automakers, vehicle parts suppliers, because their business model is set up with this idea of selling to consumers. But more and more, these sort of tech mobility companies are owning the interface between vehicle and consumer. And if that continues, are they going to sort of be cut out of the cycle, the ecosystem, which I think is a really interesting observation.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the truisms in tech is that like the more frequent touch points you have with a customer, the more powerful your organization's going to be. And that's not necessarily the truism in tech. Like you can talk about anything. The more often you go to Kmart, Guzman or Macca's, the more successful you're going to be. It just means you've got a great product. When you have a car dealership, like how often does someone go to a car dealership? Like once every 5 years?
Yeah.
Once every 3 years? How many people have a positive experience with a car dealership?
It's true. And now you've got things like carsales.com. You don't even have to go to a dealership. You buy it secondhand.
Exactly. Or dealerships use car sales now as the channel. And so, you know, that McKinsey heat map, and I'm looking at it now, like such bad colors. it is true because when you have these tech-enabled businesses or when you've got mobility solutions, even outside of like micro-mobility, the fact that you can buy a car without talking to a dealership or with limited touch points from a dealership it is incredible. And then the fact that we haven't even talked about EVs and Tesla and how all that plays out, because that's obviously another conversation. Tesla is a direct-to-consumer model. Like, they don't have dealerships. They just have showrooms. Like, they don't have these, like, opaque pricing that you get at a dealership where you negotiate the price of a car. Like, you go to the Tesla website, you see the price of a car, and that's what the price is. Like, there's no... You choose features, and that's obviously, you know, more expensive or whatnot. But there's no, like, handshakes. There's no under-the-table deals. There's no, like, dodgy dealerships and things like that. And I think that that's going to continue to be true, is that as technology consumes these, like, outdated models, dealerships are probably on their way out.
All right, Albert. Last observations, verdict, floor is yours.
I'm bullish on mobility. Really, really bullish. I think the key is always, like, how do you differentiate yourself and stop becoming from, like, a commodity service that just gets people from A to B? Because there are so many ways you can go from A to B, from walking, rideshare, scooters, bikes, skateboard, you know, hoverboard, probably soon, things like that. And so as an organization, how do you differentiate yourself? And if you can find differentiated mobility businesses, you're going to do well.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point to finish up on, Albert. You know, we hinted at it before when I was talking about my decision to choose either Beam or Neuron for my e-scooter of choice in my trip to Brisbane. You know, in my mind, there's actually zero difference between those two services. It's just like one's orange and one's purple. Otherwise, to me, it's exactly the same. Is that a problem? Arguably not, because if we're just talking about a consumer who wants to have something that's price effective and convenient and available, most likely, if I was in Brisbane long term, I'd just have both apps and I'd just be using whichever one's closest to me. And the question is whether the pie is big enough to sustain that sort of level of white label almost services. And when you're talking about mobility, that's something where I'm pretty confident to say, like, yeah, the consumer marketplace is big enough to support multiple players, even without too much of a differentiated service. I should probably caveat that. That's more like the e-scooter, bikes, etc. When you're talking about delivery and even ride sharing, it's you know, much more competitive. And we've talked about how that market's going to consolidate likely in the future.
It's such a... Sorry, I know we were wrapping up, but now as you think about it, it's just like such an interesting space, because you've got Beam and Neuron who are effectively the same. Then the person who actually wins is the person who sells e-scooters and bikes to Correct. Neuron or Beam, right? Yep. And Neuron's in a position where they manufacture their own, so it's in-house. I'm not sure if it's the same for Beam. But that's like, it's the classic, like, in a gold rush, the winner is going to be the person who sells the picks and shovels.
That's a nice place to finish up on, Albert. I like that a lot. Thank you for listening to the Fresh Capital Podcast, a podcast about companies and investing told in a refreshingly simple way. Thanks for listening. And we'll catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Fresh Capital. Every week, we provide a refreshingly simple way to learn how companies operate and how investing works. Just a reminder, all information contained in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, financial, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Fresh Capital are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any opinions expressed in the show are not recommendations or advice. Please consult a licensed financial professional before you jump in. As always, we look forward to seeing you next week. See ya!